Welcome to this TED Learning podcast discussing inclusive recruitment. Sarah H. Gordon, known as H to all of us at TED, is a recruitment expert with many years recruitment experience, supporting businesses around the world in being more inclusive in how they recruit and interview candidates. So, H, welcome to this TED Learning podcast. Tell us a little bit about your recruiting background. How did it start and how did you move into training and supporting organisations?
Okay, well, way back in the mists of time, my first role was in retail management, and I worked for a very large retail brand in management role for a number of years, and was always fascinated by the idea of bringing new people into the business. So when I left that retail role, I moved into recruitment. I went to work for a high street agency, had fantastic training, and ended up working in recruitment for over a quarter of a century, which I know is hard to believe. But, you know, I do have a natural grey streak in my hair, which I'm hiding incredibly well today. And obviously that gave me exposure to working with a whole range of organisations across public and private sector. One of the great things about being a recruiter on the consultancy side, I think, is that you essentially have to really get under the skin of every client that you're working with. So you see a whole range of different organizational challenges and issues, and I got to sort of assist my clients in solving those. Then on leaving the world of recruitment after 25 years, I decided to move into the training function, because one of the things that I really enjoyed about being on the board of directors of a recruitment firm was actually bringing people on board and then developing them. And I love that feeling you get as a leader. Sometimes you feel almost a little bit like a proud auntie as you see people blossom and thrive. So I thought, well, this is brilliant, because I get to do the training stuff and I get to do the recruitment stuff. And I've been doing that now since, oh my goodness, 2015. So yeah, that's where I am now.
And what changes have you noticed in how people recruit and onboard their staff during, particularly since 2015? What sort of things have you seen that are very different?
Since 2015, yeah, sort of onwards, we've seen one of the tightest labour markets that we've seen since the 70s. And that has meant that anyone who's recruiting has had to get a whole lot more creative. It used to be that you could just kind of post an advert, wait for the responses, pick the best one, job done. And it doesn't work like that anymore. We have to be a lot more proactive in the way that we recruit people. Candidates have so much choice. We really have to think about, as employers, what our employer value proposition is. What do we have to offer candidates? When they've got three or four job offers on the table, why are they going to come and work with us and make us their forever home, if you like? So I think there's been a lot more call for investment and innovation on the part of employers who are recruiting due to the state of the labour market. In some cases, it sometimes means that diversity and inclusion gets pushed to one side. In a recent CIPD survey, I think one from 22, that they did on diversity and inclusion in the world of work, 46% of organisations were saying that sometimes diversity and inclusion takes a back seat to operational requirements. So people essentially are desperate to fill the job, which doesn't always lead to the best recruitment decisions. So that's been a significant change. I think obviously over the years, increasingly things have very much gone digital, and then the pandemic just pushed that into overdrive. We've seen video interviews, and of course they bring with them a whole host of different challenges from face-to-face interviews, and you know, opportunities for different kinds of bias to creep in. We're seeing candidates in their home environments, for example. Usually we don't get a window into their world. Technical glitches, not everyone has the best tech set up at home, and that can sort of influence people's decisions. So those things have changed, but also just job design. Because of especially the pandemic, we've seen a lot more flexible and hybrid working. So there are lots of different challenges for leaders and managers to be working with, and different kinds of qualities maybe that they're looking for in the people that they recruit if they're going to be working from a distance.
I mean, that's fascinating, actually, because I hadn't really considered, we'll come on to talking more about kind of inclusion and how people make the process more inclusive. But you're right, you know, suddenly seeing somebody, I mean, I know I've had client meetings and clients have been perched on the edge of a bed and background, and not everybody puts a virtual background behind them. And you mentioned the sort of biases there. What can candidates, if someone's listening to this podcast back and they're thinking I am being interviewed at home, how can they help avoid some of those biases? Because we all have them. People will make judgments based on seeing somebody. What sort of advice would you give to someone?
The technology is fantastic. I mean, we've both got our lovely virtual backgrounds. Mine is because I have a really boring beige wall behind me. But you can use virtual backgrounds to hide what's really behind you. You can just use the blurred background feature. And another thing that I think is really important is if we want the interviewer to engage with us, then they need to be able to see us correctly. So simple things like making sure that you've got light facing you, not sort of sitting as a silhouette of a mystery figure in front of a window or something like that. So just sort of taking a little bit of time, maybe have a practice run with a friend beforehand saying, how do I look? Can you see me okay?
Yeah.
And just experimenting with that. But yeah, blurred backgrounds and virtual backgrounds are fabulous.
Now, you touched on the fact that in that recent survey that inclusion seems to have slipped. And obviously, organisations that don't have a fully inclusive process are potentially missing out on great talent and also creating a workplace that reflects the society and probably the customers and people that they're supporting. What sort of tips can you give to an organisation on being... On having a more inclusive recruitment process?
It's really just starting with inclusion in mind. So when you're sitting down, when a hiring manager says, right, I need one of these, it's sitting down as an organization and saying, okay, let's look at this job description. Let's search it for barriers. Quite often, job descriptions are these kind of documents that go in a filing cabinet and get pulled out every time you're recruiting, and they just get pulled out, you blow the dust off and you go for it again. And actually, a lot of those job descriptions were put together in a very different world originally. Things have changed, things have evolved. There are, you know, in a market where we had lots of candidates to choose from back in the day when I first started in recruitment, you really did have huge numbers of candidates to sift through. So we tended to put things in like, you know, must have a 2-1 degree or something like that, just to filter down the numbers to make it manageable. And actually to challenge ourselves and think, well, why do you need a 2-1 degree to do this job? Have a look around internally. I'm willing to bet there are people doing that job, probably people in your senior leadership team who don't even have a degree. So why are we leaving this stuff in job descriptions? So it's really when we're putting together job descriptions, only looking at what is an absolute must have for the job, because otherwise we can be creating barriers. I think when we're looking at the whole recruitment and selection process, again, if we kind of design that with diversity in mind, a great thing to do is to have a working group of employees, including maybe some people with disabilities, and saying, this is what we're thinking of. Where are our blind spots? What have we missed? How could we make this better? I'm a firm believer that recruitment is a team sport. We're bringing new colleagues into the organization. The more people who get involved in that, the more people as a whole, people already in the organisation, as well as candidates coming to the organisation, the more people feel that kind of everyone matters here, everyone has a voice, everyone has input. So that creates a very inclusive feel. Having really good structured objective criteria before you go out to recruit, and then running structured interviews, but you can have structured interviews that don't sound like interrogations. The danger is if you go kind of too process driven, you lose all the stuff that makes you you, that gives you personality, that attracts people to work with you. So it's finding that sweet spot where you've got structure, consistency, fairness, objectivity, and also humanity, empathy, connection, chemistry, all those great things. So those things that we need to work out. There are some things that organisations can do that not very many do that are hugely impactful in terms of inclusion. Things like when you're going out to do recruitment campaigns, think about offering sessions that give underrepresented groups a bit of guidance on how the recruitment process works. I suppose you could describe it in some ways as employability counselling at some level. But for more senior roles, quite often we find that there's diversity at more junior levels within an organisation, but it hasn't quite filtered through to the top yet.
Yeah.
But those people haven't had the same exposure, the same journey. So help them, give them some insight, share some stories with them. And that's very empowering for underrepresented groups. But so few organisations do it. But the ones that do see great results.
Some great advice there. But what if you're a smaller business? So if you take our own business at TED Learning, as an employed team, there's only 7 of us working in the business and everybody happens to be white. We have a really diverse group of trainers and actors, and we've worked really hard to build that. So if that's mirroring your organisation and you don't have that internal voice that you can go to, how can an organisation get some of that input into that process?
There are some fantastic organisations out there. So, for example, if you're looking to increase disability representation in your organisation, you could go to a charity like Leonard Cheshire, because they are a specialist disability charity. They work with candidates with disabilities on employability issues. I'm sure organisations like that would be more than happy to give advice. If we're looking around areas of mental health, you've got charities like Mind. If you're looking, you know, there are charities that cover pretty much every one of the protected characteristics as listed in the Equality Act. But actually, just give some general advice about accessibility and inclusion and making people feel welcome.
You touched on the kind of the old school thought of, you know, people have got to have a 2-1 degree to do a job and not necessarily being able to justify why that's there. What other sort of mistakes have you seen employers make in either job adverts or specs that could potentially be now putting candidates off from even applying for that job?
A key one is language. In a number of different ways, actually, bearing in mind we work in a global workplace now. We have people from all over the world. And I think historically recruitment was, you know, oh, we've got to use professional language. We've got to, you know, use impressive language that makes us look like this really amazing brand. But actually, my advice is keep it simple. If you can say it in words of one syllable, then do, because then everybody can understand. If you try and use highfalutin language, people won't understand. It'll switch them off and they'll just swipe onto the next advert. So we want to make our language really plain and simple to understand. We want to be talking about the candidate first, not starting about we're amazing, you know, we're a world leading one of these. The candidate's saying, what do I get? If I come and work for you, what do I get? So talk about the candidate. And again, because you're talking directly to them, it immediately creates that connection. It creates that sense of them being included because you're talking to them. Another thing to be aware of in language is gender bias. Now, there's been all sorts of studies over the years. I think this has been lurking since about 2001. I think it was a journal in the American Journal of Psychology, Goucher et al, I think it was, I can't remember. But anyway, it's this fascinating article that says words like senior, analytical, driven, motivated, ambitious, they all carry with them a kind of subliminal masculine bias. And words like empowering, nurturing, facilitating, guiding, carry with them a feminine bias. Now, that's not to say that those are characteristics that men have and those are characteristics that women have. It's just the kind of the vibe that they give off. So if you create an advert that's full of words that have a masculine bias, when the audience for your advert is reading it, they kind of get the vibe that this is a lot of men. And they think, oh, will that be a good environment for me? Will I feel comfortable there? There are some great tools out there that you can use to check your recruitment job descriptions, job adverts, etc., for gender bias. One of them is called Textio, which is T-E-X-T-I-O. And even, you know, job boards like Total Jobs has a gender decoder. And free, you can just copy and paste your text into there and it will say, look, this is a bit male heavy, this is a bit female heavy. And you have the option, obviously, either to remove those words or to add in words of the opposite gender to get the balance in there. The other thing in job ads, only put in the things that are real deal breakers in terms of what you're looking for from the candidates. Because if you put too many things in there, then there's been research done that if you have, say, 10 requirements in a job ad saying you must have these 10 things, if a guy has six or seven, they'll probably apply with confidence. If a woman has six or seven, she probably won't apply. She'll think, oh, there's probably people who've got eight or nine of those. So if we make sure we only put the essential criteria in the advert, we're giving less opportunity for people who would be brilliant for the job to self-deselect. Let's at least have a conversation with them. So those kind of things, I think, are really important in job adverts.
And one of the things I've noticed very often on sort of LinkedIn, for example, where a lot of jobs are posted, and seeing people really push back about this, is people not including salary information and benefits package details. And, you know, people saying, you're expecting me to apply for a job and I have no idea financially where this is sitting. Why are companies still making this mistake? Because surely, although money might not be the main driver behind it, it's a factor in all of our lives, particularly in the current cost of living crisis. People need to know, is it worthwhile me doing that? Why do you think companies are still missing that really key ingredient in the advert?
Oh, tell me about it. This is one of my real soapbox topics, because the first thing I say to employers who do this is, if you don't put a salary in, you lose one third of your applications right then and there. Because as you say, candidates are saying, that sounds really interesting, but I'm going to have to take time out to tailor my CV, to craft an application, to go through this whole process. And if I do all that, and at the end of the day, it's paying less than I'm on now, it's a complete and utter waste of my time. So for candidates, it's really important. In a job ad, they want to know what, where, how much. If you're missing any one of those, you're losing applications. So this is one of the things I bang on about all the time with clients. The typical response from clients tends to be along the lines of, we have people who are currently in the role being paid less than we are prepared to pay, and we are aware we will have to pay in the current really competitive labour market. And for me, that's a whole different issue. That's a, okay, so your pay for your existing staff is not fair and equitable. You're aware that they're worth more in the market and you're deliberately not paying them that. So that can be quite a big conversation, I think, to have within organisations. Sure. The other thing I think that can sometimes help employers who are in that situation is to put a range.
Yeah.
The danger with putting range is candidates obviously will read the advert and automatically think they are the top of the range. So there will be a part where you will need to manage expectations. But if you fail to put a salary at all, my goodness, you are losing out on some fantastic people.
Have you noticed differences in the generations? Because we're in a situation at the moment where we've got the most number of different generations in the workplace, from baby boomers right the way down to sort of Gen Zs. And then obviously we're looking at the next generation coming into the workplace, you know, in sort of 5 or 6 years. Have you seen a difference in how they seek employment and their expectations through the recruitment process?
Yes. Now, this is one of the areas I always feel uncomfortable talking about, because obviously when you start describing a whole group of people by their age, that's age discrimination, which
absolutely,
I'm completely
yeah.
against. However, I think without doubt, if we talk about just work seekers, who are actively on the market, because I think some of the things that apply to Gen Z, as people quite often refer to them, when people start talking about what's important to them, I say, hang on, I'm Gen X and that's important to me too. I think it's just the way the world is changing and the expectations of work seekers in general. But certainly when job seekers are looking for a place to work, the ethics of the employer that they're going to work for is super important to them. So people want to work for good organizations, especially post-pandemic. People want to work for organizations who will look after them and take care of their well-being. This is very much a kind of a relationship of equals nowadays, whereas it used to be very much kind of the employer calls the shots. Now it's very much about finding that synergy with an employer where you give of your best and you expect the best in return. So candidates are doing their homework. They're looking companies up on Glassdoor. They're looking at reviews online. They're talking to people in their peer group who've had some experience of working with different organisations, things like diversity inclusion, things like commitment to the environment, things like just corporate social responsibility are key deciding factors for people when they're deciding who they're going to go and work for. And, you know, that this is something that hasn't always been the case. In terms of work seeking behaviour, I was just curious. I was working with a bunch of Gen Z people recently, and I said, just out of interest, if you were to, I don't know, be going on holiday and you wanted to research where you were going to go, what would you do? Because I'm thinking to myself, well, I would go on Google and I would probably end up on TripAdvisor, you know, as my generation. And they said, oh, I go on TikTok and I put like hashtag the name of the destination, hashtag my trip to the name of the destination. So actually people are using TikTok as a search engine. So if you are looking to bring people of that age group, people who are entering the workplace, then actually think about which social media platforms they're going to be on. Think about how they look for things, because you'll reach out to a completely different talent group than if you just do LinkedIn, job boards, Indeed, you know, all the usual suspects. We need to get a little bit more creative, and it's fun too.
It's fascinating because actually delivering a training course on inclusion recently, and it was the day that there'd been a lot in the news about TikTok being banned by the government for government departments. And there was a younger guy who happened to be on the course who was distraught by this news. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, how am I going to learn if TikTok's banned? And I said, well, first of all, TikTok's not being banned for the general public. And secondly, there are other ways to learn. But I think it aligns with you saying around going on holidays and having spent time with my niece and nephews recently, that is a source of information. So it's a great piece of advice for employers to consider how they promote their brand in that space. Now, you mentioned earlier around language, and particularly how we make the process accessible to those people that might have disabilities. And I know when I'm out delivering inclusion training that very often people will be more mindful of how they accommodate physical disability. So how do I make sure the room's accessible if someone's in a wheelchair? But obviously there are lots of things covered under the Equality Act that are more hidden disabilities and not visible. So thinking of someone who might be neurodivergent, for example, how could an employer be more inclusive in their process and the interview for neurodivergent candidates?
I think one of the things to bear in mind is everybody experiences disability in a different way. So if we're looking to sort of cater for the needs of the individual, the best thing to do is always consult the best expert in the world on their disability, which is them. So certainly always having conversations around how can we support you, and then making adaptations for the individual. But if we're looking at designing a process that hopefully won't need that many adjustments because we've designed it with accessibility in mind, then simple things like for a whole range actually of mental health conditions, you know, whether it's anxiety, whether it's autism, actually a really calm, distraction-free room. Without, you know, one of my pet peeves is interviews in rooms with a glass wall, because people are walking past all the time. It's incredibly distracting. So a sort of really clear interview environment, not a lot of background noise. That's really important. When we're thinking about our question design, good practice in interviews is to ask open questions. Absolutely. It fosters a conversation. It gets people talking. One of the dangers is if you ask an open question that's too broad, for some conditions, that can feel overwhelming. A question like, tell me about yourself, which a lot of people would think, okay, I'm in a job interview. I know what kind of things I'm expected to talk about. For some people, it could be absolutely paralyzing. They're thinking, what, where I was born? How tall am I? What color is my eyes? You know, what do you want to know? So really carefully crafting our questions to be open, but with a clear focus. One of the things that can really help with that is framing the question, kind of giving a little preamble before you ask the question. So if you're asking a question about teamwork, for example, you could say, one of the things that's really important for us here at TED Learning is that we all work together as a team. With that in mind, tell me about a time when. So then you've given a clue as to what it is that you want to talk about. So those kind of practices in an interview can be really helpful. And if someone is really anxious, just using really supportive language like, I'd love to hear more about this, or I'm really keen to understand your experience in this area, because it makes someone feel safe using that kind of language. So there's all sorts of things that we can do to sort of create a good environment, and little things like in outside of the interview, multiple choice questions, they're super quick and easy to administer and nice and straightforward to mark, and they're great, but actually they can be overwhelming for candidates with some conditions. So if you can find a different way of assessing the same thing or ask the same questions, but let it be free text, then it just makes it a bit more accessible to everyone.
So some contextualizing the question to help people understand why you're asking it, thinking about the environment, the room that people are being interviewed in, so that there aren't some of those distractions, and having that sort of empathy and connection to the candidate, because ultimately we want to get the best out of them, don't we? And I think sometimes people think that an interview is that interrogation still. I mean, I can remember being interviewed in my 20s in the corridor of a building because the interviewer had forgotten to book a room, and me thinking, I don't want to work here. So some of those things are just basic principles that people need to be thinking about to create that much more inclusive process. Now, you mentioned bias earlier, and there's a number of different bias, and I know that when you're delivering this training, you talk through those. How can we make sure that bias doesn't impact or influence our decision when we're recruiting people?
It's really hard because we're human beings and our brains are designed to try and help us out by going, well, here's what our experience is of this thing before. So that's going to help me understand the situation I'm in now. So I think we need to understand that bias is part of everyone's human condition. But now that we're aware that we've got it, it's our responsibility to do our best to conquer it. One of the most important things to do is, I think, to have panel interviews. So certainly in the world of recruitment consultancy, we used to interview candidates one-to-one, which isn't best practice at all. If you've got more than one person, every person on that panel will have had a different life journey and therefore will have slightly different unconscious bias. If the members of that panel have also received training on diversity and inclusion and have received training on unconscious bias, they can then challenge each other when, after an interview, if someone says, I felt they weren't suitable because, someone else on the panel can say, oh, I didn't get that at all. What specifically about their behavior or their words made you think that about them? Because that's not what I saw. And you can challenge each other. The other thing I think it's really important, before you see any candidates at all, be absolutely clear that you have a set of objective criteria. What makes someone appointable? Let's define that first. And then we've got this benchmark to compare people against, rather than comparing people against each other or comparing people saying, oh, look, they support the same football team as me. We'd have a great time working together. All of that stuff's irrelevant. Let's bring it back to, okay, here's what we said we wanted. Do they have it? Because if they do, they're appointable. So it just helps to remove those opportunities for bias.
How do you see recruitment changing over the coming years? What things do you think may happen in this world?
I think we're already seeing some of them happen. There's lots of people at the moment talking about things like ChatGPT and AI and everything. And lots of organizations are talking about using AI to do the screening, to do the sifting rather, to create the shortlists. And there are some people who say, this is great because if machines are making decisions, then there won't be any bias in there. But unfortunately, machines learn from previous examples. So we don't live in a perfect world. They're learning from imperfect examples. So I think it was Amazon who introduced a recruitment bot at one stage, and they had to turn it off after about 24 hours, I think it was. They turned it off very quickly, because what the recruitment bot did is it looked at all the executive team in Amazon and went, oh, look, most of them are men. So the first thing I'll do when I'm sifting is get rid of all the women.
Wow.
So when AI learns from imperfect examples, it perpetuates bias. We have to be very careful. Also, it's worth being aware that in the Data Protection Act, one of the individual rights that was introduced in light of GDPR in 2018 was that people have the right to object to automated processing. So if you do use AI to do your sifting, you should be transparent about that. Candidates should know that so that they have the opportunity to say, actually, no, I don't want to be sifted automatically. I want someone to read my CV. But there is certainly going to be an increased use in AI, in screening, in arranging interviews, in some of that stuff that used to be person to person is likely to become automated, which part of me understands, commercial drivers, etc. And part of me is terrified of when even the people who invented AI are thinking, oh, I just want to step away
what
from
have I
this
done?
Now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that there is, we need to watch this very closely. And if you are looking to use those new technologies, have a look at the outcomes that you're getting, measure what the changes are, because if it's having a detrimental impact on inclusion and diversity, my advice would be get rid of it. Because it's so important to have diverse teams in the workplace. You know, research that McKinsey did in the States said that companies with diverse senior leadership teams outperformed those with non-diverse teams by up to 35% financially. You know, that's how significant the difference is that's made in organizations.
And it's not a box ticking thing, is it? This isn't just going, you know, because sometimes I know when both of us are out doing our training and we've talked about the importance of diversity in the workplace, and people have said, yes, but you know, our organization, all of the directors are white men because that's how it's been. Are you saying we just need to appoint somebody as a token? It's not about that, but it is as you touched on earlier, it's making sure that people that are from underrepresented groups can see a career path and can see that they can move into senior roles and supported and encouraged. I know a former colleague of mine who happens to be a black female who works in HR was told when she got to an HR manager's role and was looking at her next move, no, you've done well. That's the kind of level that you need to stick at. And she went on to be a group people director to prove everybody wrong. So I guess one of my last questions to you is, any organisation that's listening back to this podcast thinking, we've got some work to do, where should they start? What should they do?
I suppose I'm a little bit biased because the first thing I'm going to say is train people. But one of the things that's really interesting is that typically when we look at diversity and inclusion initiatives, only about 7% of organisations have a specific diversity and inclusion budget. And if it has the potential to make such a difference to your organisation, put some money behind it. Invest in it. It's so important. At the moment, most of the organisations that are doing anything around diversity and inclusion, that gets taken from the learning and development budget. And actually, it's important enough to have its own dedicated budget in addition to learning and development rather than sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul. I think there is so much great information out there. There are books on becoming an inclusive leader. There's loads of stuff. If you want to learn, there is nothing that can stop you. You can go on. There's whether you're a young learner and you're going on TikTok, whether you're a more mature learner like myself and you're going on YouTube, or whether you reach out to organizations that have the expertise in the area that can share case studies with you, that can share stories of what other organizations are doing. Just start a conversation with someone, ask for help and support on your journey. There are so many people out there who are on your side and want you to succeed. It's just ask the questions, be curious, talk to people. One of the things I think around diversity and inclusion is sometimes people don't have conversations because they're scared of using the wrong words or saying the wrong thing. As long as you're willing to learn, have the conversation. Say, I may say the wrong thing. I'm embarrassed to say I'm very ignorant in this area, but I don't want to be anymore. Help me learn. People will. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I always say that in inclusion training is don't be frightened of getting something wrong. It's how you react and respond to that when you get it wrong. So if you misgender somebody and they correct you, it's not going, oh, this is political correctness gone mad. It's going, I apologise for getting that wrong. I understand. I'm going to learn and move on from that.
Yeah.
Why does this matter so much to you?
I think that there's two things. With my kind of former company director head on, it's very much, well, it's a commercial imperative. If organizations want to be successful, these are the things that they need. And having a diverse team brings so many advantages for the organization in terms of innovation, challenging the status quo, challenging that kind of real complacency and stale thinking. If you get a real mixing pot of people together, it's an exciting environment. And people who are working for you will have a much more rich working life. They will have exposure to a whole range of different ideas, and we all learn from each other. And the more different someone is, the more you learn from them. And I actually really enjoy working with people who disagree with me because we have so much fun discussing why. Anyone who just agrees with you, it's like, oh, boring. Who wants to work with a load of yes men? Nothing exciting happens there, does it? So from that point of view, I think it's super important. But the other thing is just on issues of fairness. We're born how we're born. I think it's outrageous that my life would have been different if I was born a man. In terms of my working life, it shouldn't be like that. It should be about who we are and what we can contribute and how we add value, not the packaging that we come in. It's just, it's so important. Everyone's a human. We're all wonderful. We're all different and unique and fabulous in our own way. And we just need to embrace that in the workplace, and then the world would be a much nicer place.
And you've been unique and fabulous in this podcast. H, thank you so much for your incredible insight into how we can make the recruitment process much more inclusive, how we can consider the interview, and also just thinking about some of the things that candidates can consider when applying for jobs and prepping for an interview. It's been a genuine pleasure to talk to you this morning. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
For more of our podcasts, visit our website at podcast.tedlearning.co.uk, or you can find us on most podcast platforms.